Welcome to the EDUCAUSE podcast. This podcast features a session from the EDUCAUSE Learning Initiative 2011 annual meeting. Our speakers include Susan Henderson, Director for the Florida Distance Learning Consortium, and Jade Roth, Vice President for Books and Digital Strategy for Barnes & Noble. The session is entitled, The Open Textbook Puzzle.
What I wanted to talk to you about is the future of the textbook. And where we're headed. I looked into my crystal ball, as you can see, and it's not completely clear. I think we're still trying to figure out where we're headed with the textbook. The textbook is fraught with issues of economics, academics, and technology, as Malcolm pointed out. One of the ways that we feel that we can solve the textbook dilemma that we have is by looking at open textbooks. We started with economics. When we found out that our students were paying more in textbooks than they were in the cost of tuition, we realized that we had a serious problem that we had to do something about. And we began to look at open textbooks. There's been a lot of discussion about what is an open textbook, and so I just wanted to present a couple different definitions for your consideration. The first one came from the Student Public Interest Research Group, that's the ESPIR group, and this is what their definition looks like. And we sort of adopted that one in the beginning. And as you can see, cost is the primary emphasis in this definition under number one, you know, that the books can be read online, self-printed, or downloaded via any computer with internet access at no or low cost. And then also in the second part there, at modest cost. So the students are focused on cost. Is that what's missing from this definition? Well, let's look at a second one that we wanted to promote. This one is more focused on what the permissions are. And it allows us to look at that faculty can read, students can read, download, copy, distribute, self-print, search, or link to the full text. And this is really important without financial, legal, or technical barriers. But truly, there is no definitive definition yet. I think we're all still working on that. But these are two definitions for you to consider. So what's important here? It's Creative Commons. I think through the week you've heard quite a bit about Creative Commons. And so there's basic conditions and optional conditions that you need to be aware of. The basic ones are just that you need to give attribution to the authors. And for the most part, it's the materials are for non-commercial purposes. And then there are all these optional conditions. But it's Creative Commons that gives us the commonality to work with these materials and do what we want to do, and allow our faculty members to do what they do best, which is to teach. So when we looked at open textbooks, these are the priorities that we came up with for our initiative. We started with the most important was affordability. We want to ensure that our students can afford their instructional resources, and you'll see why that's important in a minute. We want to see that faculty can take these materials and do what they do best, which is to customize them and include their own materials and make them adaptable. And then students can always access these materials, that we don't put any barriers in their way. So keep those in mind. Affordable, adaptable, accessible. These are our priorities. But I'm suspicious that there will be another word that's added to these soon. So as we looked at open textbooks and the economics and the issues, we decided we need to look at who are our stakeholders in all of this. And I don't think you'll be too surprised, but here they are. Students, faculty, and the faculty's institutional leaders. But then there's another level that's higher up, the Florida higher education leaders, the executive and the legislative leaders, and the citizens of our state, because when textbooks are too expensive and our students can't afford an education because of them, we have a problem. And that's the impact on Florida's economy, because we're not educating the people that we need to. So We wanted to look at what are the issues for our students and our faculty, and so we did some surveys. As part of this Open Access Textbook Task Force that I chaired recently in 2009 and 2010, we did a survey of our faculty, and we heard from 2,707 faculty. They were at our community colleges, which are now becoming state colleges, and our universities. So here's the breakdown of who we heard from. The majority were faculty, and almost 10% were administrators, and it was almost even between colleges and universities. I don't think you'll be too surprised at this, but at the universities, who makes the decisions for the textbook selection? It's the faculty members for the most part. 69% of the faculty members actually make those decisions. But that's pretty different at a community college or a college. It's done at a department level. But this graph really struck me. How many faculty are familiar with open access textbooks? Look at that, not at all. 52.1% of all the at all the institutions, all the faculty, didn't know anything about open access textbooks. And the very familiar, look at the numbers down there. At all institutions, 7.3%. So when we saw these numbers, we knew we had a communication issue and we needed to solve that one for sure. So we asked some more questions. How many faculty had ever used open access materials? Look again at the numbers. Very low. 10.8% at the colleges, 12.9% at the universities. And most of these had not even used open textbooks. They had used other types of supplementary materials. It was a little interesting that administrators reported that they had used open access materials in higher numbers. So I'm going to show you the top 10 reasons that make faculty members decide to use open access materials. And just to be a little different, we're going to start at number 10 and work our way back. So the least important reason was the impact on the bookstore. And this scale ranges from 1 at the lowest to 3 having the highest priority. So we'll just go through these real quick. Recognition, support from the administration, availability of materials like test banks, environmental concerns, hardware and software, desire to reduce cost to students, that's getting close to 3, knowledge about open textbooks, time. Time is always a factor for faculty. Now, what do you think is the top priority? I don't think you'll be surprised, but it's quality, academic quality. Another issue that came about, was identified clearly through this survey, was tenure and promotion. When we look at it, we do what we are rewarded for, right? So we found that most tenure and promotion decisions do not include open access materials. Okay, so we wanted to hear from the students as well. And so let me just share briefly, from these surveys, these are just highlights that I'm sharing with you. But students told us, give us choice. Don't tell us the format in which we have to interact with our materials. Let us choose. And I think at this point in time, they're saying the technology has not caught up with their needs. Approximately 70% of the students still want the opportunity to buy a print textbook, but they also want the opportunity to be able to download it to one or more devices. And this is information that we got from over 14,000 students in our state from both universities and colleges. This was just our public institutions. It did not include our privates. And my plan is to repeat this survey annually because I think the dynamics and the information we receive from the survey will change over time. But here's what we heard. We asked the question, what measures have you taken to reduce your textbook costs? And they could check all that applied. So what have they done? They have bought new or used books from a non-campus source. That's 72.3%. They bought used copies from a campus bookstore at 64%. And then going down, they've sold used books, they share books. But you know what was stunning to me was the one in green. They 37.1% said they do not purchase textbooks. And then it goes down from their rent, e-version, and down in the green at the very, close to the very bottom is a new area that I think will continue to emerge, and that is that they bought chapters of e-textbooks. Okay, we also asked them to select the three most important features of a digital textbook. Not surprisingly, search at 63.9% was the most important feature. And then time available for use. It sounds to me that the students don't want their textbooks to disappear. And they want the ability to self-print them. And then going down into the next section is highlighting. They want to be able to purchase a commercial book, copy and paste, and add notes. This was a really interesting question. The cost of required textbooks has caused me to, and we looked at not register for a course. It sounds to me from the comments the students made that they had chosen courses based on the cost of the textbook materials in many cases. In a few cases, it looks like they've had to withdraw from a course. They have failed a course because of the cost of required textbooks, as they reported to us. And again, a lot of them are just not purchasing the textbook. This was a fun question, too. What study aids help you achieve a good grade? Practice questions. By and large, 87.9% said that makes them successful. And they like to review those PowerPoints that you all make. They want interactive try-it-now activities. And video helps as well. And you can go down the list. But those are the primary things that make them successful. This was another interesting question. We wanted to know, because we have to sustain open textbooks, all right, are you willing to pay a small fee when an open textbook is used in your course to maintain the currency of that textbook and also to provide some additional money to create new textbooks? And as you can see, 47.2% of the students said yes, that they would support a $5 to $10 fee for open textbooks. And 40.3% said maybe. A lot of them said, I need to know more about what is an open textbook. I need to understand this better. But I think that's a overwhelming support for a fee for open textbooks. So as we looked at these survey pieces and we looked at where we're headed with all this, we decided that there were four major components that we needed to address. And they came from a repository from the University Press of Florida, WebAssign, and Print on Demand Publishers. And I want to go through each one briefly in the time that we have here. What does the Orange Grove do? The Orange Grove is our digital repository for the state of Florida. So in there, we can store files and URLs for content, especially for these open textbooks that are very large and very large files. We collect metadata. So faculty members can know if there's a textbook for their course. They don't have to go out and dig around. And so that access, that accessibility that everyone said they needed is there. So this, we felt, was a strong solution to identified need. Our faculty have limited time resources, and we need to help them make it easier to find open textbooks. So we feel that this is really critical to supporting open textbooks. And then through the Orange Grove, students can even self-print these textbooks. They're not limited, and they can download the textbook to any device that they want to, or multiple devices. We don't care. It's there for them to choose. We're supporting their choice. And we also make available that commercial print copy. As you saw back there on the survey, quality is the number one issue for our faculty. So when we engaged the University Press of Florida with us, what do you think that did? It really elevated quality within the open textbook project that we had, because they are a professional publisher and they're highly recognized within our state. And they've won awards. It's an amazing group to work with, but they bring the full publisher skill set to open textbooks as we develop. And they can also do the peer reviews. So this, we felt, was a strong solution to an identified need. And then we brought on board WebAssign. As you saw, the students indicated that they wanted those practice problems. WebAssign was started by North Carolina State University. It's a FIPSI grant. And they bring to the table the ability to offer all these problem sets that are in the back of the book that are randomized, there's algorithms, and it's this dynamic online homework system. And we're getting feedback that this makes students successful and is a wonderful companion to the open textbooks. Then we have the print-on-demand publisher. And we feel that that's important because our students want that choice. They want the opportunity to buy the print book. That book may be going away in a few years as the technology catches up. But today, they still want that security blanket of the print textbook. A few of them said, you know, what if my device gets lost? What if I break my device? What if I lose all the notes that I have in my device or it gets stolen? I'm sunk. What am I going to do? So we feel that it's still a very strong need to have a print book available, and they can buy a print book a lot cheaper than they can go to Kinko's and have it printed. And this print-on-demand publisher that we're working with has locations around the world, so any book can be printed within 24 to 48 hours and quickly delivered. So we launched Orange Grove Text Plus. That is our open textbook project. And it is a partnership of all four organizations. We launched it in September of 2009. And we were excited because we had about 50 books. Today we have about 210. So this project has just recently, we've launched Concepts of Calculus 1 and Concepts of Calculus 2 will be published soon. This is Dr. Sergei Shabanov, and he is an associate professor of mathematics at University of Florida. Their provost has been extremely supportive of open textbooks. And I talked to Sergei last week. He did a webinar for us, and he said, open textbooks works for me. Why? Because he said, I know my students, and I've written this book, and anybody can go in there, including myself, and customize it for the needs of my students, and it makes them successful. And it makes me happy because I can do what I do best. This is kind of a flat book. We know that. It's a PDF. But we're doing this with no new money. And so at least we're creating an opportunity for our students, and I think this will evolve over time. But the addition of the WebAssign allows us to embed links back to the textbook and to videos and to learning objects and to any kind of open educational resources that would make the students successful. And it's at a very low cost, $25. So we feel like we've put together a good package for our students. So the remaining hurdles that we know of, sustainability. Obviously for all of open resources, sustainability is an issue. How do you support this once the grant funding goes away? So we're looking at that fee for our students when an open textbook is used in their course. And most of the leadership in Florida is beginning to see that that's an important part of this. We need to have an adequate supply of quality textbooks. We also need a simple customization tools so our faculty can go in and add their research, add their examples. And then we need to do a better job of marketing and informing our faculty. And tenure and promotion, that's a huge issue. We have to get to the reward system. Today, we're looking for other states to partner with us on open textbooks. We have commitments from, and I know the Kentucky Commission on Postsecondary Education is out there remotely today, so I said to give them a shout out. They have made a strong commitment to helping to develop those 25 general education textbooks, as has the Tennessee Board of Regents. And we've got strong interest from these other states and expressed interest from another. If you or your state would like to join with us or your institution in developing those textbooks as open educational resources, please join us and let me know. I just want to close my remarks with something that I received in an email from Eric Christensen, who is a professor at South Florida Community College. And he wrote me and he said, the open textbook movement at my college is really gaining momentum. A student came up to him and said, are you that open textbook professor? And he said, yes, I am. And she said, I want to thank you on behalf of all the students at our college. And then Eric closed. He said, this is making a difference because my teaching has improved the performance of my students because, again, I can adjust immediately for the needs of my students. So the open textbook is a piece of the puzzle. It's a piece of the future of the textbook. I don't think it's going to be the only solution, but it certainly is one piece of that puzzle. So I encourage you to learn more about open textbooks. Go to our website, and it's www.openaccesstextbooks.org. As part of our FIPSI grant to study open access textbooks, we are putting on there everything we learn as we can document it and a model for the creation of open textbooks. So it's a journey, and we encourage you to become a part of that journey.
Thank you. Okay, so Susie has talked a lot about student research and faculty research and a lot of general information, and I always find it either terrifying or reassuring, and I'm never quite sure which, that it mirrors much of the same information that we get when we survey the faculty and the students that we serve as well. So we're seeing very similar types of responses from students. They're focused on cost. Faculty are focused on outcomes. And they're all looking at this changing world of educational materials. And what I'm going to talk about a little bit sort of puts some context around what Susie talked about, which is open source as a content piece. I'm going to talk a little bit about the transformative market that we are in, where open source is becoming very much a piece of that. So if we first look at the student, today's student is dramatically different than the student of 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 30 years ago. This student is savvy. They're market aware. They expect everything all the time. They have very high technological expectations. If they walk on a campus and they don't get Wi-Fi in a spot, it's a problem. You know, they just expect an awful lot. And they look for parity across channels. So from a retail perspective, what that means is they look for the same thing in-store as they get online. Okay? If we look at textbooks, we also see that this is an industry in huge flux. Formats are changing. Traditionally, and I've been in the bookstore business now for 31 years, just about, and for years and years and years, we dealt with two formats in the college bookstore, new textbooks, used textbooks. That was it. The student choice was about price, but it was 25% off the new book price, and that was basically it. But today, we're seeing a lot of different formats come up. Rental is one. A year ago, we had 6 stores that had a rental program. Today, we have 450 stores, or roughly two-thirds of the schools that we serve now have an active rental program. Rental programs, on average, save students 50% off the new print price. And digital has changed dramatically. So we're now starting to see digital as a format. We have sold digital books in our bookstore since 2003. And the sales were nothing, not even like 0.0003. until this fall. And we started to see those sales really take off with a 3,150% increase in sales over the prior year. So that is an area that's changing. Content is changing dramatically. There's multimedia, there's open source, there's audio, there's test assessment. They're all sorts of different content. And distribution requirements, again, are in-store and online. And the access expectations are everywhere all the time. But whenever I have these kinds of discussions, I have to go back to the core data, which is really, what are faculty truly using today? And when I look across the 633 bookstores that we serve, I see a vast array of information that's being adopted. So across those stores last year, there were 229,000 titles that were used by our faculty, different titles. Of those, only 5,000 had a usage of over 1,000 units. So, you know, in our industry, we always talk about the 80-20 rule. We talk about that all the time in business. But the fact of the matter is, faculty are using so many different things. And even though Campbell Biology and The Art of Public Speaking are our two best-selling titles, that's really nothing in the scheme of what's being used. 16% of these titles don't even have ISBNs. So what are those? Those are compilations of materials, articles from newspapers, faculty's own work. 22% were custom. 10 years ago, there was no percentage like this. You know, custom is a huge business over the last 10 years, customized for a course, for a professor, for a campus. 24,000 of these titles had a digital option. This is an interesting thing to look at, too, because if I look at last fall, so fall 2010, our digital to print ratio was 8.7. And then when I look at winter, it jumped to 19.6. So this digital transition is really about content availability and some student behavior shifts. Out of that, we collected 2.5 million adoptions. That's personal touches with faculty, and those books represented 7,661 publishers. So there's a lot of stuff being used. When we talk to students, they tell us three things. I want choice, convenience, and I want it cheap. And then they want to understand what they're doing. We've had to make a big change as a retail organization in the past year, because if you look at digital materials, it's not just the same. It's not selling a student new and used, or even rental. Rental's a concept everybody gets immediately. But with digital, there's so much more going on. DRM requirements, restrictions, EPUB versus PDF. You think, why would a student have to know something like that? Well, you know what? It affects their usage. It affects how they look at it. It affects page fidelity. It affects the professor who wants to say, go to page 34 in that textbook. So all these things have to be messaged to the students. And as we look at what's happening in this arena, we are seeing that 14% of students have purchased a digital product in the past year. Dramatic differences. And 18% of those who purchased it did so for the features. So Susie talked about that PDF and ingesting it and putting it up there. Well, that's okay. You can read that online. Okay. But that doesn't change the experience. It doesn't give them the number one feature that Susie wanted, which was search. Search across your whole library. These students want to consume this material differently. Okay? And 10% of the students who purchased an e-textbook did so because they were curious. Now, this is a very interesting group of students. They're willing to try new things. And then the biggest thing that we've seen is that when students are offered a choice, for the first time ever, 5% of them are opting for the digital book. That is a huge transition. And it's those types of fast transitions that are propelling this last stat that I think is up there, which, not yet, but coming soon. We're projecting, and it's not just Barnes & Noble, it's other people in the industry, that digital materials, whether they're open source or whether they're publisher curated or whatever they might look like, will be about 20% of the market by 2016, so in about 4 years. As we start to look at tools that have to meet all these needs of students, we have to look at what students are facing today. These students are very content pressured. You know, they have got stuff coming at them from all over the place. You can see that just walking on a campus. You walk into a cafeteria, a student has three books open, they've got Facebook on their laptop, they're talking to a friend, they have multiple streams of information. That's going to continue. So really, it's how you manage that information and what you give them to help that process that's going to make the learning material make sense. Students want a study ecosystem, if you will. So they don't just want that book on a Kindle, Nook, laptop, anywhere, thing like that. They want, again, to today replicate what they do in print in the digital world. And the reason I say today is because I think that's a really important point. When we talk to students and faculty, they're all about, okay, I want to highlight. I want to make a note in the margin. I want to go to this page. They are replicating their print experience digitally. But that's going to change quickly, because as students start to get into the digital materials, they're going to start to realize that this replication isn't enough, that they're going to want to do things that they can't even think about today. It's like when you learn a language, right? Your teacher says, or at least my teacher said, Jade, quit translating in your mind. You just have to speak it. And I could never do that, so I don't speak German. But that is what students are struggling with today. They're translating print learning behavior into a digital world. And when that starts to change, and they start thinking digitally and what they can do in that environment, we're going to see huge leaps in learning materials. As we start to get all this data, and we've been really mining this type of data, looking at how students learn, looking at what happens in a classroom for probably about close to 3 years now, we developed a product. And I'm not going to demo it today. I would want to be very conscious about not making this a Barnes & Noble presentation. I really wanted to make it about the industry. But I would encourage you, if you have some time, to go to nookstudy.com and download it. It's a free e-reading application. It's designed for PCs and Macs, because 95% of students have those tools already. It allows you to highlight, take notes, pull in links from other sources, sideload any document that you might have into this, arrange it by course. So really, it is a first pass, if you will, at an study ecosystem for learning materials. We are continuing to enhance it. In just a couple of weeks, we will be rolling out text-to-speech and some other accessibility things, such as full navigation, things like that, that are going to be important as we continue to go down this road. But I want to talk to you about one of the biggest challenges to this digital transition. And Susie touched on it a little bit when she talked about students wanting to be able to cut and paste and print and all those things. As students are getting into this digital world, they're realizing that they don't like the restrictions that are out there on their learning materials. You know, these are kids who are used to just repurposing everything that they have in any way that they want. And so when they get a textbook and they download this textbook into their study ecosystem, and all of a sudden a window pops up that says, oh, you can only print 87 pages in the next 30 days, they think, well, I want to print 88. Not because they need to, but because they want to. You know, so it's this whole idea about how students interact with these materials and how they view restrictions. Again, when we talk about DRM, because this is a huge issue for us right now, when we talk about DRM, it's not so much that they need to print more than what the publisher allows. It's that they feel they have a moral right to do so. And so this process of educating students and faculty around these types of things is going to be a huge challenge in the next couple of years. People always say to me, look at music and the way that went, and aren't you worried that digital educational materials are going to go that way? And I think there is a big difference in this, in these two channels. And one is that when music went digitally, first it was already digitized, you know, music was already out there. And it didn't change the way a customer or a person interacted with the music. They still listened to it. They still had a portable device. They still could listen to it in their house. It didn't change the listening to the music piece. But with educational materials, they don't just listen, they don't just read, they consume, they interact, they want feedback through test assessment banks. It's a whole different world. So I don't think we're going to see that same thing, but I do think that the road is going to be bumpy for quite some time. So again, that sort of builds on what Susie talked about in terms of open resource being a piece of this pie, and I just wanted to sort of step back and say the pie has lots and lots of changing pieces right now. And each one of those pieces is critically important because faculty use 229,000 different learning materials in a given year, and that's just in the 600 stores we serve. So that was it.
You can find more podcasts like this by visiting www.educause.edu/podcasts. You can also search for EDUCAUSE on iTunes. Thanks for listening.